You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
So I'm with Ashley Church. He's a commentator on a number of issues and well-respected, but one of them that he's been commenting on for quite some time is around housing. So Ashley, welcome to the show.
G'day, Simon. Nice to talk to you and good to see you on RCR.
Oh, well, I'm enjoying it. It's a great station. We've touched on all sorts of views or topics, rather, from Taiwan to the monarchy that is, the curriculum through to how my wife met. So I thought we should get onto a serious topic and talk about housing in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Well, to throw you a look, let's just jump straight in because it's something a lot of people talk to me on the street about. They're worried about first home buyers, they're worried about rental, mortgage payments, the consumer not building enough houses. But if I might, you've often had a slightly different take on issues. And I know of late the now national government or the coalition government, whatever they're calling themselves, has been pushing a particular set of views or lines, and you haven't always agreed. So tell us what's going on or not going on in the New Zealand housing market, according to Ashley Church.
Yeah, so you're right. I have taken a different viewpoint quite consistently, almost belligerently so, over the last sort of 10 years, certainly with respect to the previous government, who just were noddies, who didn't have a clue about how the property market worked, but also with regard to the current government, with regard to some of the positions that they have taken, which, while I understand why they might have taken them instinctively, are not necessarily going to solve the housing issues that the country faces. And it's interesting because when you have this debate around the housing market and dealing with the housing crisis, and that's a term you hear a lot in the media, Simon, when you use this term housing crisis, there's actually three quite different things that people mean when they use that term, and they're almost mutually exclusive. So there's a group of people for whom the housing crisis is the fact that for them, house prices have got out of control and they're too expensive. And therefore, as a result of that, people can't afford to buy homes, particularly first home buyers. And as a result of that, and so that's the housing crisis. The crisis is the fact that house prices are too high. And then there's another group, completely different group of people, for whom the housing crisis is not about house prices so much. It's about homelessness. It's about this idea that there are people who are living rough on the street, or who are living in very, very temporary accommodation, and therefore the crisis is not so much about what house prices cost, but it's about the fact that there are people who simply can't access homes, and therefore that's what the crisis is and that's what the government should be addressing. And then there's a third group, and that's this group of people saying, no, it's not about either of those two things. The housing crisis is about a shortage of housing. So it's about this idea that we haven't built enough houses over the last 40 or 50 years, and therefore we don't have enough homes and we need to build more homes quickly in order to increase supply and get it back to a point where the country can actually, you know, see itself as being in a reasonable position again. So really important, firstly, to understand that there is not one housing crisis, there's three. There are quite specific adherents of each of those positions, and they are to some degree mutually exclusive from each other. So does that make sense?
It does. It does. I mean, can I just tease at least one of them out? Because, you know, number three, you talk about the housing shortage, and I hear about that a lot. But as I drive about or fly about, for me, there are just, and this is only anecdotal, but there are new houses being built left, right, and centre. I'm looking out my home window at the moment, and the number of subdivisions is phenomenal. So to me, and again, I really want to stress it's anecdotal, there seems to be lots of houses. So is it that we're just still not producing enough? I mean, what's going on there?
I'll come back to that a little bit later on because I want to sort of work through some of the other issues first, but that's a really good observation, so thank you for that. By the way, when I talk about these three issues, if I was to define this current government in respect of its position on housing and what it sees as the crisis, that last one, that supply one, is probably the one that probably best defines Chris Bishop's position. He sees a housing shortage as being the crisis that him and the national government need to solve. But let's go to each of those individually, because my argument is, and you talked before about having a different view, my argument is that, in fact, each of those crises aren't crises at all. And that when you look at the reality and the facts of what's going on underneath the surface with the housing market, that all three of those can be dismissed for different reasons. So let me start with the first one, this idea that that there is not, but that house prices are too expensive. And look, anecdotally, you can understand why people would hold that view. House prices have doubled every decade for the last 40 years. They've doubled and then doubled again and then doubled again and then doubled again. And we can prove that. We know that by looking at the house price data. And house prices obviously haven't got, sorry, incomes obviously haven't gone up by the same degree. So you can understand why people might look at that and say, well, gosh, you know, house prices have increased dramatically. Therefore, the result of that has been that we've now got house prices out of control. So the problem with that is whether it's right or wrong, and this is really my first point, you actually can't control house prices. So my first advice to the minister would be, you cannot control what happens to house prices. And there have been governments over the last 40 or 50 years in this country who've been ground on the rocks of failure on that. Governments that have come in thinking they could control house prices, doing different things to control house prices, doing stuff around immigration, doing stuff around consenting with councils, all sorts of other things, some of which this new government's trying to do again, which have made, and this is really important to understand, Simon, not one jot of difference to house prices over that 40-year period, not one jot of difference to bring them up or down. And there's a really good reason for that. It's because house prices aren't controlled by all of the various things that you instinctively think they might be. When I say the one driver, about 90% of all house price growth, and you can demonstrate this empirically if you look at graphs and charts, about 90% of all house price growth is driven almost exclusively by the declining cost of money over the last 40 years. And what that means is as the cost of mortgages comes down, or the cost of mortgage finance comes down, house prices have come up. And that link is so strong that you can actually demonstrate it empirically on a chart. You can show what's happened since the mid-80s when we had mortgage interest rates sitting at over 21%, and what's happened in the 40-odd years since, and house prices are now at the levels that they're at. So as the cost of money has come down, the house prices have increased over that same period of time. And that's now so, that link is now so strong that to deny it is to deny reality. And what that means is, and you can actually see a really good example of that happening right now, the Reserve Bank's going through this process of trying to get inflation under control, and it's doing that by putting the OCR up, which is causing mortgage interest rates to go up. What's happened to house prices? They've stabilized or even dropped. In fact, they went through a period where they dropped in some parts of the country by almost 20%. So that causal link between the two is absolutely proven.
So elements that you mentioned, consent, some people would say, like the price of building and so forth, you're saying that these are not, they must be factors, of course they are, but they're not material.
Yeah, there's immigration controls, there's regulation, there's the discouraging of land banking, I'm reading from a list here, discouraging from unoccupied homes, banning foreign buyers, punishing property investors, removing the urban-rural boundary, which is a big thing that Chris Bishop's working on at the moment. All of this stuff has been around trying to control house prices by focusing on a feature of the market. The problem with those is if they impact on house prices at all, it's on the fringes. It's a tiny percentage of the total overall impact. The overall impact is 80 to 90% of house price increases have been due to the declining cost of money.
So if I put it in sort of simplistic Simon terms, the fact, because I always remember my folks talking about their first house and 21% interest and so on. Yeah. At the moment, because mortgage rates are so much lower than they used to be, I mean, up to a few years ago, my mortgages started with a 2, which were good, should have locked them in for longer. But long and short, if mortgage rates are lower, that means there's more money, there's more capital, which means more people have saved money to try and buy a house, which makes it more competitive, which ultimately drives the market up. Would that be a fair summation?
Absolutely. And the last 40 years has been absolutely absolute evidence of that. That's what the market's done. As the cost of money has come down, the ability to purchase, to pay more for housing has gone up. Now, there's a second point to this. There's a corollary of this, which is that, okay, so the first point I'm making is to the minister, or to anybody else who's interested in this stuff, you actually can't control house prices. There's nothing short of regulating mortgage interest rates, and you know, good luck with that. There is actually nothing that a government can do to control house prices up or down. The market will do what it does based on what's happening with the cost of money. But here's the second point of the points I want to make. Second point is, why would you want to stop house price growth? And when I say that, people, they gasp as if, oh my God, what does that mean? Are you actually suggesting that house prices should continue to increase? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. And let me give you some reasons why, because people don't actually sit down and think this stuff through, Simon. If you think about what's happened with house price growth over the last 40-odd years and what that's done. So the first thing to understand is there's a Swiss-based crowd called Credit Suisse, and Credit Suisse do a survey once, I think it's every 5 years, where they measure the wealthiest nations in the world. Now, I think in 2020 was the last time they did it, and that report came out and it measured New Zealand as the fifth wealthiest nation on earth. Now, that's not about individual incomes. It's about assets and about wealth that people actually hold. And they went on in that report to say that most of that wealth that was held by New Zealanders was in the form of real estate, because a big chunk of Kiwis own their home and house prices have continued to increase. Now, here's the thing. When you look at what Kiwis do with that, what do they do with the equity in their home? So they buy a house. There's a period of time where they've got a small amount of equity, equity being the difference between what you paid for it and what it's worth. And that grows over time as your mortgage stays the same or reduces, but the value of the house increases. And as that gets bigger, you can use that as a security. And what do people do with it? They establish and buy businesses. They fund business cash flow. They travel. They fund lifestyle improvements on their home or in other ways. They spend within their local economies. They provide their kids with opportunities, including education. They fund community services through their rates. And there's a whole range of other things. So my argument is that house price growth and the ability to use that growth for equity to do other things has actually been an enormously beneficial factor in our society. And in fact, it's not only has it been the driver of growth over a 40-year or 50-year period, but it's what's made us one of the fourth or fifth wealthiest nations on the planet. And long may that continue. And you know, you need to temper that by saying people are buying homes and paying more for them because they can afford to and because their own wealth is increasing. So when that stops, when we get to a point where they can no longer afford it, the market will be self-regulating. People will stop doing that. Now, there is a third point to that. And people say, well, that's fine for you, actually, because you've got a home of your own. And
I'm about to raise where I think you're going to say, look, if you're existing, if you're already a homeowner, your argument makes sense. But I think you're about to anticipate there. What about someone who's trying to get on that ladder?
Totally. And that's exactly what people say. They say, well, that's all very well for you because you've already got your own home. And so you're not impacted by what's happening with house prices. But what about those poor people who are looking at getting into their first home? What about them? They can't afford it. Well, here's the really interesting thing, and this is where the argument starts to get really interesting, is house ownership numbers aren't declining. And Simon, they haven't been declining for about 100 years. And so when you ask people what percentage of homes do Kiwis own, they'll say, some people think we've got the highest rate of home ownership in the world. We don't. We never have had. Some people think it's really low. You're probably aware of the actual figure. A lot of people won't be. The average home ownership rate of Kiwis going back to about 1926 is about 64-65%. And here's what's interesting. That's almost exactly the same as the United States, Canada, the UK, and Australia. So all of those countries sit at about 64-65%. They deviate a little bit. New Zealand got a little bit higher some years back, a little bit lower. So, but by and large, that long-run average stays pretty much the same and has done for a really long period of time. Now, here's what's interesting. We're still right now sitting at about 65%. That figure hasn't changed. As I say, it went up in the late 80s. It went up to, got up to about 70. And there's a range of reasons for that, which I'm happy to discuss if you want to. But the long run average hasn't changed over that period of time. So what that tells me is that even though house prices have increased exponentially, because they have since the 80s and gone up, doubled and doubled and doubled and doubled again, that the rate of ownership of homes by first-time buyers has actually kept pace with that. And what's interesting is when you look to see who's been buying homes over the last 20-odd years and you look at the mortgage take-up rates by the various different banks, first-time buyers, with the exception of a couple of quarters over the last 20 years, have almost without exception been the biggest group of buyers in the market. So they continue to be a significant purchaser of homes. So if I was looking at those numbers and I was saying house prices have gone up and as a result of their home ownership's gone down from 64 to 50 or 45, that would be a different conversation, but that's not what's happened. About 34, 35, 36% of Kiwis rent. The rest of the country, regardless of what period you're looking at, remember over that period of time, we've gone from about 1 million people in 1926 to tapping on 5 million or more now. That percentage has stayed stubbornly the same. So that kills off that concern that people have gotten for me. It's confirmation that whatever is at play here, it's not doing damage to the first home buyers market in and of itself.
Do you have any thoughts then of why the narrative is the way it is? Because, I mean, my whole time in Parliament and before and still now is we've got a housing crisis, we don't have enough houses, too many migrants, too expensive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet you're saying quite clear that the statistic, the analysis, the numbers show that actually things are pretty much the same as they've always been in a general sense. So, I mean, why do you think we end up with this political or media narrative?
But the same reason that we've got people out there who are saying the tax system's unfair in favor of people who are wealthy, when exactly the opposite's the case. It's exactly the same argument. It's the so-called progressive agenda, which has got more which is more about the ideology of people who are making those comments than it is about the reality of what facts don't matter with this stuff. People ignore the facts because they don't support the argument. And that's not just true in this space. It's true in so many different things in life in the 21st century, unfortunately. But there is a very large group of people who buy into that. Well, firstly, there's a smaller group of people who say this stuff because the narrative's about a bigger political objective. And then there's a much larger group of people who don't know and they just believe what the headlines tell them. And a media who kind of feed into this stuff because, again, they don't know any better. When you take a bit of time, and it's true of all the stuff around the property market, and I guess if I've contributed anything over the last decade, it's been to simplify a lot of this stuff, is if you just take this stuff and you distill it down and you actually look at what the numbers tell you, it's not that complicated. And not only is it not that complicated, but the system actually works pretty well. And it's worked well for a long time. And when it does get to the point, yeah, it will. When it gets to the point where it is too expensive for house prices to continue doubling decade on decade, the market will moderate that on its own. It doesn't need a government to do it. It doesn't need a bank to do it. It will work it out on its own, and it will naturally settle into that. And that will take place over decades, not years. So as that happens, instead of taking 10 years for house prices to double, it might take 20 and then 30. But that'll happen over a long period of time.
So is there an argument, actually, that governments make things worse? And that's not arguing left or right, but actually the more governments try to intervene, the more complicated or messy it becomes? That being your observation, I'm thinking the likes of LVRs or loan to value ratios. I know now the Reserve Bank's looking at debt to income restrictions. So
the Reserve Bank, if you want to look for a culprit, so I said before that first time buyers have continued regardless of what's going on in the market, and I still believe that, and I still believe that they will. But their biggest enemy by a country mile is the Reserve Bank. And not only is their biggest enemy, it's not their enemy doing things that are good for the market overall. So if you know, you could say, oh well, look, I understand that whatever the Reserve Bank's doing is hurting first time buyers, but they're doing it for this reason. There's none of that. They're doing stupid stuff for no reason. And I'll give you two really good examples. The first one is the loan to value ratio restrictions. Loan to value ratio restrictions came out in 2013 under Wheeler. And he introduced them at the time, and I love this story because people don't know it. You go back to when they did it, you went to their website and their press releases, they claimed they were doing it to reduce house prices. They claimed they were introducing the loan-to-value ratio restrictions to reduce house prices and bring house prices down. Over the next 5 or 10 years, house prices doubled. So it didn't work. About 5 years in from that, the Reserve Bank quietly changed its narrative, took off the original stuff on its website, got rid of the original, and just simply changed the narrative and said, actually, it was never about house prices. It was always about market stability. And so the argument moved from being it was about bringing house prices down to we're making the market more stable by making people produce a larger deposit. Now, the problem with that argument is that prior to them doing that, and certainly in the late 2010s, up to 2010, 2011, you could buy a house with as little as 5% deposit. Market didn't collapse, Simon. Market carried on fine for the 20-odd years before that when a 5% deposit was perfectly acceptable. So my point in that is the Reserve Bank made absolutely no difference to the market whatsoever, but continued with this bloody-minded obsession with the LVR restrictions, even after it became obvious that they weren't actually producing what it was originally said that it was going to do. And I would argue that if there is an imposition to first-home buyers now, it's the LVR restrictions. And if you're not going to get rid of them in their entirety, then the next best thing would be to say, okay, we're not going to put them on first-time buyers. Because if you want to turbocharge first-time buying in the market, you'd get rid of the biggest imposition, which is a deposit, and make it easier for people to come up with a deposit to buy a house and enable the banks to actually lend to them. But they're not done that. Now, on top of that idiocy, there's a new set of idiocy, which is around the DTIs, the debt-to-income ratio restrictions. And the DTIs take this idiocy a step further, and they say, not only are we going to have our LVR restrictions where you've got to have a certain percentage before you can, as a deposit, before you can actually buy. But now we're going to tell you how much you can borrow. So if you're on a household income of 200,000, might be a couple in Wellington or Auckland or somewhere, or less than that if you're in other parts of the country, the maximum you'll be able to borrow will be, I think the figure they've come up with is $700,000. So if you live in Auckland, good luck. Good luck with that $700,000 minus your deposit or plus your deposit buying you a home. It's nonsensical. And there'll be some parts of the country where you can do that. There'll be some parts where you can't. And the problem with that is that, once again, the people who will be most penalised by this insidious policy are first-home buyers. Because if you've got a home, I've got a home, we've built up equity in our property. If we want to upgrade to a better property, all we're wanting to borrow is the difference between the property that we're selling and the one that we want to buy, the better home that we want to buy. So it's a much smaller loan. So that 7 times income for us isn't going to be such a problem. But if you don't have a house, so therefore you don't have equity in a property and you're starting from scratch, it's going to be a major. So I predict that that policy will be gone within 3 years. And I say that because its impact on the market will be far more insidious and far more devastating than even the muddle-headed OVR restrictions which came in some years ago. Both of these things, now I'd be saying to the minister, to in this case to the Minister of Finance, to Nicola Willis, you should be taking the ability for these guys to off them. I believe that an independent reserve bank is a good thing, but this stuff's got nothing to do with inflation. This is nothing about inflation. This is nothing about keeping prices down in the market. This is about the Reserve Bank pursuing an obsession with nonsense. And in my view, this should be removed, and the minister should be taking this out of their remit the next time she renegotiates with Orr, who frankly, in my view, shouldn't be in the job because he's incompetent and unable to do what a Reserve Bank governor should do. But that's a whole other issue. So
in many ways, you'd leave this with the banks. Then they're the ones who can make the decision of whether to loan to you or me or not, rather than what do they call the macroprudential tools.
Macroprudential, yeah, totally. This should be entirely with the bank of the and again, the banks might come out and say, well, we're not going to go down to 5% deposits because we think that's unsafe. That's reasonable because that's the bank's own lending decision. They're entitled to do that, but the Reserve Bank shouldn't be making that decision. It's got no place in there, and it's making no difference to the market except to penalise the poor old first-time buyer. Because the reality is what would happen, some banks would say, no, we're not going to do it because we think it's unsafe. And other banks would say, well, we are. So that's how competition in the market should work. You'd get competition and you'd get banks who were prepared to go. I don't know if you remember, but in the late 90s, as they were back then, United Bank introduced revolving credit facilities, which were an innovative thing back then. Nobody had them. No banks didn't have them. And now every bank offers them. And that just completely transformed the housing market, and all the other banks within about 12 months did the same thing as well because competition had forced them to do that. And that's what competition does. It's a great way of getting the best deal for the customer. Under the current system, we got Adrian Orr in the Reserve Bank deciding that they know better than you or I or the poor old first home buyer as a purchaser.
So in many ways, what you're suggesting is you're clearly a believer in the market, let the market do what it wants to do, but part of your argument within this space is that ultimately governments and the Reserve Bank over many years have interfered, tinkered around, played around, and actually made things worse.
Much worse. And mostly to the detriment of the poor old first-time buyer. Because the rest of us have got a bit of equity, so we could, you know, even property investors, because this is, all will claim that this is about getting investors out of the market. Well, no, it won't. I mean, it'll have a crack, but if property investors got a portfolio of more than a few properties, this isn't going to matter to them so much because they've got enough equity to actually still be able to buy more properties, provided interest rates are at the right level. It's the first time buyer who's going to be hit by this stuff, and they'll be hit hard. And it's just nonsensical. There's no good reason for it. So that's the first one. So the first one, remember right at the beginning, I talked about the first housing crisis or property was this idea that house prices were too expensive and that therefore it was. And so I think I put the death to that. I've said, firstly, you can't control house prices. Secondly, why would you want to? Because they've actually been a good thing, increasing house prices. And thirdly, the one group that you would think were actually adversely impacted by this, despite what I just said about Adrian Orr and the Reserve Bank, have actually managed to carry on at about the same. But so home ownership has stayed at around about the same percentage of the market. Similar numbers for about 100 years. So my argument is that puts the death to the first housing crisis claim. So that destroys the argument of anybody who makes that one. Second one, a bit more complex. And the second one is this idea that, by the way, any questions on that before we get off that on to the second?
No, well, only one last question if it's related, because the government's been tinkering around the interest deductibility. This is more in the rental space, ring fencing interest loss as well, or rather as an expense. Do you see that sort of stuff as tinkering as well, or is that slightly different?
I'll come back to that. I'll get to that a little bit later on because I deal with that in some detail. And it's a very good question. So the second one is this idea that the housing crisis is actually an issue of homelessness. And the last government was really big on this. It was this idea that that homelessness was the major blight on the market, and that we had thousands of people who were stuck on the social housing register. Now, for those who don't understand what that is, the social housing register is a register that's, and you'll know better than this from your days in government, which of the agencies currently administers it, MB?
So Ministry of Social Development administers it.
Now, the ministry, now the social housing register is a register of want, not need. And let me explain what I mean, the difference between those two things. So the last government came out, they said, we're going to, back in 2017, they said, we're going to solve the housing crisis, make it much easier for everybody, fill your boots, basically. And without saying it, it's essentially implied if you want a government house or a state house, we'll provide one. So the social housing register went from 6,000 people to 25,000 within the space of about 2 years. And I don't blame the people who put themselves on it, but they weren't necessarily people who needed a state house. There were people who saw that if I'm on a state house and I'm paying 30 to 40% of income or whatever the figure is of subsidized rental that I get on a state house versus what I might pay to the private sector, of course I'm going to want a state house. So when those numbers went up, they weren't necessarily a reflection of a greater degree of homelessness. They were a reflection of the fact that lots of people, and if I was in their position, I might have been the same, wanted a state house because it was going to be cheaper to be in one of those than it was to be in a private sector property. Now, here's the thing.
You'd almost be foolish not to put yourself on the list and think about it.
Of course. Now, that's not the reality. Most Kiwis, if you ask them about homelessness, they've got their idea of homelessness is this idea that you've got a whole lot of people who are living literally on the street. And so it's important to make the distinction between those two things because according to Stats New Zealand, now these figures are a couple of years old, but they won't be made much different. There are two different types of homelessness. There's the first group, which is what we call the rough sleepers. And these are the people who either live literally on the street or they live in improvised dwellings. And they're the people who you see in doorways and things in Auckland and Wellington and the major cities of the country. Then there's a second group, and these are the people who are in temporary accommodation, which is unstable, by which I mean they might be able to stay with your brother or sister for a couple of weeks, but it's not permanent. You're going to have to find somewhere else in a couple of weeks' time, or you're in a caravan, or you're living in a motel on Fenton Street in Rotorua, or any one of a number of those other temporary living space situations. So the number who are living hard, 3,500, and the number who are living in temporary accommodation, 7,500. Now, so between those numbers, about 11,000 people. Now, that's still a lot of people. But I think if you said to people it's 11,000, they would be stunned because most people think that number is much, much, much larger because of the figures that they hear through the media. So the people who are actually living in a situation that you and I would legitimately describe as homeless is actually a relatively small number of people. Now let's break that number down because if you look at the 3,500, most of those people, not all, but most of those people live in those circumstances. Not the reason that they're living on the streets got nothing to do with their economic position. It's to do with things like mental health issues, substance abuse issues, other issues which are impacting on their lives. And in a lot of cases, and when you talk to some of the agencies that look after them, you'll often find that they'll take these people off the street, they'll put them into accommodation, and a week later they're back out on the street because it's got nothing to do with economics. It's not to do with how much money they're earning or what's available to them. There are a set of other issues, really important issues, that as a society we need to be cognizant of and work to resolve with them, but not about the economics of property. In fact, not about the property market really at all. That second group, that's...
Yeah, sorry, and I can, by the way, I'll just jump in because I can concur with that. I used to work with the homeless, granted, in Sydney, Australia, but actually a lot of those guys and women who are on the street in the doorways, you're right, it's mental health issue, drug addiction, alcohol, and so forth. So, yeah, we have to help them. The other is that what I would often, and I argue this when Labor was in government, the conflation of the numbers, because they'd often combine the 3,000 on the street, the 7,000 in sort of that transient space, and then the 30,000 on the waiting list, and say there's 40,000+ people.
Homeless.
Yeah. And I argued clearly unsuccessfully is that actually by conflating that number, we end up not focusing, I would suggest, on the people who really need help. It just made it too big, too dramatic. Well, I was homeless probably by definition a few years back where I was staying at a mate's house for a couple of weeks in between homes. That's ridiculous to conflate that with living with a drug addiction on the street, but that's the problem of overemphasizing or conflating numbers. Anyway, I've interrupted you again. You're the expert.
Oh, no, that's good. That's good because you're absolutely right. So if you accept those first two figures, 3,500 and 7,500, 11,000, that's about 0.2%. 0.2% of the country's population, not in any way to diminish the importance of the need to help those people, but tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the population of the country who are actually impacted. So my second point being, we don't have a homeless crisis. we've got a homeless problem that we need to fix like any other country, but we're probably in a much better position than lots of other nations in the West by dint of the history of this country and the fact that we have had state houses and a more enabling attitude toward things like accommodation supplements and things over the last sort of 40 or 50 years. So again, first crisis, affordability. I think we've dismissed that. Second crisis, homelessness. Dismiss that. The third crisis, and the one that this government certainly buys into and the last government with Kiwi Build also bought into, was this idea that we've got a supply issue. And so the supply crisis is the one that says, no, we're not building enough homes. We don't have enough homes available. By the way, I should just make the point, because I talked before about the number of people, and this comes back to your question, I talked before about the number of people who rent, and there's about 35-36% of people in this country who actually rent the home in which they live. So therefore are reliant on rental accommodation. And it's interesting because when you this whole idea, certainly from the last government to a lesser degree, this one is that Kāinga Ora is the solution to this. And I think a lot of people have that too. They think, you know, the government's got to build these houses because these people are homeless or in straitened accommodation circumstances, and the government's got to provide a solution to them. Here's the problem with that, and this is the thing I don't think Kiwis realize. Kāinga Ora only actually owns about 10% of the total rental housing stock in this country. It's always been only around about that sort of 10% mark. There's a few more owned by non-government agencies, might take that number. So councils, Salvation Army, a few others that own rental accommodation might take that number to 10 or let's say 15% of the total rental accommodation stock. The rest of them, about 500,000 houses in New Zealand, are owned by private property investors. And that's a really, really important discovery for two reasons. One, because it demonstrates that Kāinga Ora is not the great white hope that's going to solve this problem. It simply isn't a big player in the market. Private investors are by far and away the biggest. But secondly, and this is the bit that the previous government completely missed, private investors are absolutely essential to the housing market, to the extent that if they didn't exist and we had that 36% of people in the country who needed to rent accommodation, the state would have to step in and provide that, and it would bankrupt the country. And that's a really important point to understand. And the reason that's so important is because when you look at what the last government did to private investors and what it did to the private investment market, absolute insanity. Any government, if it's concerned about housing and concerned about making sure that 35 to 36% of the population has a roof over its head, should be doing everything that it can to make it as easy as possible for people to invest in property. Because those people are essentially taking that liability off the government's balance sheet and putting the risk of it onto the private investor. And that's the only way you can look at it sensibly. Anything else is insanity. Anything else is insanity. And yet you had a government, you had Grant Robertson and a government that were basically saying, we're going to get property investors out of the market because they're a blight on the market. Absolute insanity, Simon. Absolute insanity.
So it became just a direct attack, didn't it, on effectively the mum and dad landlords, a cheap political ideological point, attack the very people who are providing, if I've heard your stats correct, about 85% of the rental market.
Yep. And again, that figure's been relatively consistent. New Zealand's actually very lucky in respect of its private investment in the rental market. And it's interesting because there's all sorts of views on how that happened. My personal view is it started in the late 70s, early 80s, and it started, and you'll remember this for other reasons that will relate to you, it started because Bob Jones was heavily involved in property investment back in those days. It's before he got involved in corporates. A lot of people listening to this won't even know who Bob Jones is, Sir Bob Jones. Bob Jones was an extraordinarily eccentric figure in the New Zealand political landscape. He was a property investor in the late 70s, wrote a book called Jones on Property and talked about property investment, ran seminars up and down the country. Tens of thousands of people attended those seminars, and it effectively transformed or created an industry that didn't previously exist. And that industry has just gone from strength to strength over the last 40 years. And it has meant that a provision of housing that would have been the government's responsibility has been transferred to the private sector, and they've taken all the risk of it over that period of time. So for a government to come in and say, we're going to do something about this and get these people out of the market, just insane, just insane, just completely misunderstanding how the market actually works. So the point you were asking me before, which is around the things that the current government's doing, they're doing exactly the right stuff, getting rid of the bright line test, or removing the bright line test back to 2 years, which is what it should be. By the way, the reason the bright line test came in the first place was up until the introduction of the bright line test by National in 2016 or whenever it was, There was some debate over what constituted an investor and what constituted a property speculator. And the difference between those is, if you were a speculator, if you were buying and selling property quickly, then you were trading, which means you should have been paying money on the capital gain that you made on the property, paying tax on that. If you were a property investor, then the tax should have been on the income you made off the rental, not off the value of the property, because you own the property over a long period of time. The problem was that there was no set rule on how long that should be. And so what happened is that IRD would often go back 10 years and look at your accounts and say, okay, you're a trader, and people would take them to court and IRD would lose. And so the government decided, okay, they needed to have a line in the sand that said, if you sell within this period of time, you're a trader. If you sell after that, then you're a property investor. And in the former, you would pay tax on that, effectively capital gains tax. And 2 years was about right, because if you're trading in property and you haven't sold within 2 years, you're not a very good trader. So anything after that, you're a property investor. So, and that was reasonable. Don't think anybody debated that. Labor then came in and increased it 5 years, which that had nothing to do with trading or property investing. That was just a capital gains tax. And then 10 years, and that was definitely just a capital gains tax. So in putting that back to 2 years, they've restored it to about where it should be. The interest deductibility tax deductibility of interest is absolutely reasonable. It's the same as what we would apply to any other form of business. And the fact that we made a distinction and started calling it a loophole, which is what the last government did, was just obscene. It was taking away a balanced and even playing field and trying to introduce an ideology and mixing an ideology with an economic imperative and achieving neither.
It just increases costs amongst other. I mean, look, obviously, I've got my political biases, but exactly, it's the tenants. Exactly where I was going. The tenant ends up paying more because the landlord's having to pay more.
And you saw that. You saw rents going up over that period of time. It was a direct consequence. It's interesting. I say to people, renters who are upset, I say, well, if you want lower rents, you're going to vote for a national government, because national governments do things that bring the cost of renting down. Labor governments do things that push it up, because you end up paying for it. You're the fool that ends up paying. That's not entirely true, by the way. Because that's the other misconception that people have, this idea that that landlords are fat cats, and when they're putting rents up, they're just creaming the profits off them. In fact, in a lot of parts of this country at the moment, landlords are actually heavily subsidising their tenants, because the interest rates and the rates and the maintenance and insurance and all those other costs of owning the property are far in excess on an annual basis than what they're getting in rent. So they're actually paying more to own the property than they're actually getting back on the property in rental. And so, as I say, it's subsidising the tenant. And people say, well, why would you do that? And under the current market, it's a very good question. Traditionally, the reason you would do it is because over the long haul, your property would increase in value. And a lot of people do that because they retire. They use it as a retirement fund. But you can't sustain that. You certainly can't sustain it in the current environment. And one of my predictions is that on the 1st of July, you're going to see an avalanche of property investors starting to put their properties on the market, because the 1st of July is the date that the government returns the bright line test back to 2 years. So there's going to be a lot of property investors who are just holding on by the skin of their teeth, who are going to put their properties on the market after the 1st of July, because they simply can't understand to sustain them for any longer. So that's the next one. And then the last one was, as I say, this idea that we weren't building enough homes and we weren't building them quickly enough. And that's one that this current government buys into. It's this whole idea that supply issues threaten to derail the market. But again, and this is an unpopular view, and I think me and a cat somewhere in Otago hold this view, there is no housing shortage. There is no housing shortage. And I'll tell you why I can say that with such certainty. Because people say, well, how can you say that? Because, you know, this report, we've had this housing shortage for the last 15 years that the government's been talking about, both National and Labor have been talking about it. Let me tell you where that came from. It came from a Labor Party conference in 2012. And it was introduced as a policy, this idea that we were 100,000 short, 100,000 homes short. And it came from a policy that was introduced by Annette King and David Shearer. So that's how far back it goes. You remember those names, long gone from politics. And it got picked up by the Labor Party as policy. Labor, a National, while they were still in power under Nick Smith, also bought into it and started doing stuff to fix the so-called supply crisis. And then, of course, when Labor came in 2017, they put it on steroids. Well, they didn't actually. They put it on verbal steroids, but actually did nothing. They introduced Kiwi Build, which was supposedly going to build this 100,000 homes, and I think built three or something. That's not fair, but it wasn't many. Anyway, here's the interesting thing about it, because then you would say, well, surely it was true, because they came up with this figure of 100,000, and it must have been based on something. So I should first admit that for the first 4 or 5 years, I was a believer in there being a supply crisis. I bought into it. I kicked the national government in the shins over this and said you should be moving faster to get more houses built. And then I came to the realization I'm about to go through with you in a few moments and realized that it wasn't. And then I went back to find out where this Labor announcement had come from. I thought, well, they must have had some report or something they were referring to. There is no support report, Simon. And so I looked and looked and looked. I thought, where did this come from? Was there a university paper? Was there something? I finally found where it came from. And it's in Bob Jones, one of Bob Jones's books from 1981. It was the Labor Party's election manifesto in 1981. That's where that figure comes from. And they had dusted it off. And they had put it out there again because it had been popular the first time they used it, and they thought they'd give it another go. Without a word of a lie, that is where that policy came from. It was a populist election idea that they thought would go down well with their voters.
Now, here's some of the rumors have been too that by the time it got to the more recent elections, that Annette King, I think Phil Twyford initially had suggested 50,000, but they then thought 100,000 sounded better and more politically winnable.
It's just ridiculous. Here's why I can be so sure. There's only two measures that you need to look at to tell you whether or not you've got a supply crisis or not. Because a supply crisis, by definition, is you have more people than you have a shortage of homes because you have more people wanting a home than there are homes available for them. That's the definition of a supply crisis. So there are two figures you can look at to tell you whether or not that's true. The first of them is the population of the country, and it's really easy to measure the population of the country. You can get it on any given day from Stats New Zealand. They'll tell you what the estimated population is. Then the second figure that you need to compare with that is a figure called the average household occupancy, and that comes out once every 5 years. And that figure comes from Stats New Zealand. It's part of the census. And that what that figure tells you is that if you look at the sorry, I've lost my train of thought for a second there. The average household occupancy tells you that if you go to the census, that's how many people lived in a home on census night. And that number's been dropping, Simon. It was 3.29 people per household in 1986. It's now dropped to 2.85 from memory in the latest census. Now, here's the thing, and think this through for a moment, the logic of what I'm about to say to you. The only way that number could drop, well, actually two ways. One of them is the population's has decreased, which of course it hasn't. Or the other one is you've actually built more houses than you previously had, and you've built more houses than you require just to stand still. Now, if you calculate those numbers, what they'll tell you is that between 1986 and about 2015, we built 585,000 more houses than we required just to stay at the level we'd been in the 80s. So not only do we not have a housing supply crisis, we'd actually increase the housing stock relative to the population of the country. So there is no supply crisis.
Yeah, so what you're saying is if we had a supply crisis, we'd have more people living per home.
That 3.2 would have gone up. It might be 4 or 4.5 or 5. It's not. It's come down. So you understand the logic of what I'm saying?
Yeah. There'll still be, I assume, averages, though. I mean, I can think of some, thinking of my former constituency where you literally have three families. Yes. Shoved in. So this is picky for listeners not to.
And there will be parts of the country where that number has gone up. So there will be parts of the country where there is a supply crisis, but there's not a general supply crisis in New Zealand overall.
And I think that's sort of the theme to get across to people. We're talking generals here. Everyone will be able to think of an example that's contrary to this, but in general terms. Look, that's actually quite fascinating. Sorry, I've interrupted you.
No. So anyway, so let me summarize. So the three crises that we talked about before, housing crises. One was a crisis of affordability, one was a crisis of home ownership, and the other one was a crisis of supply. We don't have a crisis of affordability. I think I've demonstrated that pretty clearly with the numbers I've given. We don't have a crisis of homelessness. It's a very, very small number as a percentage of the country overall, and we don't have a crisis of supply. So the three things that we focus on when we talk about the housing crisis, none of them are real.
Which is, well, I think, going to stir up a number of people, but in a good way. And this is one of the reasons to have brought you on, Ashley, is actually to debunk some of the myths. I was trying to think of sort of housing mythbusters. But, you're someone who's clearly looked at a lot of the statistics over time and been able to draw that here. So a big, big thank you. One last little question of not seeking financial advice, but particularly to first home buyers listening in, what would be your encouragement to them?
Oh, keep doing what they're doing and work within the rules that are available to you. So a couple of rules. One, don't wait, buy now, because people are saying, time the market, wait, buy now, because it doesn't make the sooner you buy, the better, and the long-term consequence of that will be in your favor. And secondly, the rules are the rules, work within them and just get into a home. And if it's hard, work that little bit extra to get in. Don't wait till it's easier, because it's never going to be easier.
No, look, I don't have your expertise, but I tend to agree with that. It's just like there's no better time than now. Get on that ladder. It's always, and it's never been easy. It's never been easy. Ashley, I'm so grateful for your time and very much looking forward to the feedback on this. But thank you for not only doing a lot of that research, but distilling it into such a way that I think is quite understandable by lay men and women like myself. So thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Let's talk again soon.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.